Okay, thank you very much. I'm Stefan Weiss, I mean, I said it in the morning already, and I'm talking about turbulent rotating Ray-Van Haar convection. And this work is basically done here at the UCSB in the group of Günter Hallers. And we have heard a lot of talks about convection in the last weeks and today. But if you go to very large scale system, like on geophysical and astrophysical scales, all these systems, they just rotate, yeah, because they are planets like the Jupiter or stars like the Sun. And their rotation is very important and has a very strong influence on the convection you see and also on the heat transport. And if you see, look at the Jupiter here, you see very nice stripes, and these are just caused by Coriolis force and centrifugal forces that occur because the Jupiter rotates. And it's also very similar if you look at the atmosphere of our Earth. All these climate zones are as they are just because we have rotation. So I will address in my talk three major points. The first one, I will say something about the influence of rotation on the heat transport. And the second one, I will say something about the large-scale circulation in cylinders with aspect ratio 1/2 when no rotation is present. And I think this is important because last week we had a very interesting talk by Eric Brown, who presented us a model and explained us the dynamics of a large-scale circulation in a cylinder with aspect ratio 1. But it turns out that the dynamics in a cylinder with aspect ratio 1/2 is quite different than to the dynamics of the LSC in aspect ratio 1. And I need to address this point first before I come to the influence of rotation on the large-scale circulation. Our experiment is pretty standard. We have a cylindrical vessel, and we have a warm plate at the bottom and a cold plate at the top. During one experimental run, the temperature of each plate are held constant, and we adjust the energy input into the bottom plate so that these temperature difference and the temperature at the top and bottom plate are constant. If the temperature difference is large enough, then most of the heat is transported by turbulent convective motion from the bottom to the top. And in our case, the cylinder is filled with water. At most of the experiments are done at 40 degrees Celsius, average temperature of 40 degrees Celsius. And this gives us a Brundle number of 4.38. Unless I show, whenever I show data that are not, that don't show data with this Brundle number, I will mention it. If there is no Brundle number labeled, then you have in mind that this is Brundle 4.38. The important parameters are, of course, the aspect ratio between the diameter and the height of the cell, the Rayleigh number, the Brundle number, and we measure the heat flux in terms of the dimensionless Nusselt number. If we now let the whole cylinder rotate about its inner axis, then we get an additional number, that is the convective Rossby number. But we rather take the inverse of this convective Rossby number, just because this inverse is direct proportional to the angular velocity of the whole cylinder. And the inverse Rossby number compares the Coriolis forces with the buoyancy forces. Okay, let's show you some experimental results. Plotted is the Nusselt number as a function of the inverse Rossby number. So in this direction, the cylinder rotates faster. And you see for very small rotation rates, very small inverse Rossby number, the Nusselt number is pretty constant, not much happens. And then here there's one point where the Nusselt number increases, so the heat transport increases. It reaches a maximum there, and then it falls down. So this increase can be addressed to a phenomenon called Ekman pumping. I will say a little bit more in one of the next slides about this. And the decrease, especially here, the last points, they are due to Taylor-Broadman effect. Now, Taylor-Broadman theory basically says if you rotate very fast so that the Rossby number is zero and the Ekman number is zero, then fluctuations of the vertical velocity in vertical directions are suppressed. And we just want to call it Taylor-Broadman effect. I mean, the fluctuations are not completely suppressed, but they are reduced, and therefore also the heat transport in vertical direction is reduced, and therefore you have actually at very large rotation rates, a smaller Nusselt number than without any rotation. I have to say also something here at this point, it might be also that there is a maximum because the Ekman pumping becomes less efficient at one point. Okay, you can do similar experiments for different Rayleigh number. You see basically the same behavior. Note that I normalized every Nusselt number by the Nusselt number without rotation here. So it doesn't matter what Rayleigh number you apply, you see the same behavior. At first it's a constant behavior, then you have an increase and then a decrease. However, different Rayleigh numbers, if you change the Rayleigh number, you also change the height of the maxima and also the location of the maxima. But you do not change the point at which the heat increase appears the first time. And you want to call it the next as, well, that's a critical inverse Rossmann number because there the heat increase appears.
Is that dip real?
It is real, yes. I will say not too much about this, but you will see the next slides very, very deep. So here you see it, right? So it goes first down and then increases. So this is basically, these are the same data as I've shown before, just different symbols. There is a critical inverse Rossby number where the heat transport increases and is independent of the Rayleigh number. We see the same behavior also in numerical results that agree very well with the experimental results. Note that here is a slightly different Brundle number, but the interesting case is that you have the onset and numerics can reproduce these results very well. Now, of course, it's interesting what happens if you change the aspect ratio. Here we have three plots with three different aspect ratios. I would want to point out that the experiments and all the numerics you will see are the experiments on aspect ratio 2 and all the numerics were done in the Netherlands in the group of Detlef Lohse and Herman Klerks and Richard Stevens probably did a very major contribution to this. And so you see for all aspect ratios same behavior. If you go to very large Rayleigh numbers or small aspect ratios, you see here a substructure, which we don't really know yet where it comes from, but you have definitely here a strong increase at a critical inverse Rossby number. But it's interesting that the location of the critical inverse Rossby number changes with the aspect ratio. For aspect ratio 2, it appears here at 0.15 or 0.12. At the aspect ratio 1, it's close to 0.4, and at aspect ratio 1/2, it's above 0.85. So let's summarize just what I said. It's the critical inverse Rossby number depends very strongly on aspect ratio and is independent of the Rayleigh number. So let me explain you where this heat increase comes from. If you rotate the cylinder and plumes are emitted from the, let's say, the bottom boundary layer, then due to rotation, they start to turn, to swell into a cyclonic motion, and you create in this plume a slightly larger angular momentum or slightly larger vorticity. And whenever you have a difference in the angular velocity of a fluid at the boundary layer and an infinity, you create something called an Ekman pumping. So you create a vertical velocity in the direction of these vortices. And due to this effect, you pump basically hot fluid out of the warm thermal boundary layer into the fluid. And the same thing, of course, also happens at the cold top plate. You see this very nicely here in these simulations.
Does that mean that on top they rotate in a different direction?
No, they rotate basically
all the same.
They rotate in the same direction. So you can either have a pumping effect that the fluid, that the vertical velocity goes towards the plate, or you have a sucking effect that the vertical velocity goes away from the plate. But this depends whether what rotates faster, close to the boundary, so the boundary or the fluid.
Ah, I see.
Yeah. So in both cases, the fluid rotates faster than close to the boundary. So you see here very nicely, these are the vortices, and they are very hot. I mean, this is a temperature field close to the kinetic boundary layer. They are very hot, and this really implies the theory that in these vortices, fluid is pumped from the boundary layer into the bulk. And you see this even nicer, maybe on this picture, because it shows temperature isosurfaces. The left side is without any rotation. You see here there's some fluctuations due to plumes that are emitted from the bottom boundary layer. But as soon as we switch on rotation, this hot fluid is really transported effectively into the bulk. And this, of course, enhances the heat transport rather strongly.
This is the stationary state or the transient?
Well, these are statistically steady states. So, I mean, you have statistical fluctuations.
So there is no spin up, spin down complication on this?
No. Okay, since I said already that the vortices are responsible for the heat enhancement, it is worth looking to these vortices. And they are shown here as black spots. These are just areas that are covered by a vortex, and these cross sections are very close to the thermal boundary layer. You see, for very small rotation rates, you have only a few vortices, and if you increase the rotation rate, then you get more and more vortices, and also they become bigger and bigger in size.
How do you define the vortex?
Well, there is the so-called Q criteria. Maybe Richard can say a little bit more. So basically what you do, you have the strain rate tensor and the rotation tensor, and you couple them.
Thank you.
Okay. So it's of course interesting to see how the area that is covered by the vortices, well, the fraction of area that is covered vortices, we want to call it A bar, increases this increasing rotation frequency. And that is shown here. This is, of course, from numerical results, because in the experiment we cannot look into the flow, and all the data that say something about the vortices are due to numerical calculations. You see here that basically for very small inverse Rossby numbers, not much happens, and then if you increase the inverse Rossby numbers, Rossby number above a critical point, these quantity A increase, so you get it's just says that more area is covered by vortices, and they're scattered, but it's close to a linear relation. So what you also can do, you can average in azimuthal direction, and you get a curve like this. I have to point out there are only 8 snapshots, therefore it goes pretty much up and down, but if you increase the statistics a little bit, you will see, well, that at least in the bulk, you get more or less constant behavior, and then towards the end it goes down. I also have to say something to this bump. This is most likely real, so it might be that these vortices are a little bit pushed out to the sidewall, but I will not address this issue furthermore in this talk. Okay, so we try to model this, or we suggested a model that has the form of a typical Ginzburg-Landau equation. These equations are well known from pattern formation, where they tell us something about the time derivative of the complex amplitude of, let's say, a periodic function, a periodic pattern. But we use this form that we know and say, well, A should be the local vortex density, and the time derivative of A depends on a linear term of A, and then we need a damping term, so we choose a cubic term, and then we also let A diffuse, and we have a diffusion term. So we do what one usually does with this kind of equation. One looks for steady solutions, and it's pretty, well, one steady solution everybody sees immediately, which is A1 equals 0. But the question is this solution stable or not? Therefore, we apply a small perturbation with a very small amplitude, a growth rate sigma, and the perturbation should be periodic in space. And note,
stability growth rate, you put like square omega or inverse Rossby number squared. Why? Is this some kind of a natural argument for it?
Well, I mean, I can argue that, first of all, we don't have negative inverse Rossby number, so it should be positive. But the second argument, probably a better argument, is that with this model, we get the results that compare very well with our experiments.
How about your linear law?
Yeah.
Well, wanted to see if you have a theoretical argument. There must be.
Wait. One over Rossby is proportional to the rotation.
Yeah, so you have omega. You have omega squared as a driving instability. It's actually instability rate.
That's right, because you know you want this to be a positive quantity.
I mean, there's no negative inverse Rossby number.
Just like if you apply a magnetic field to a system, you find an effect. Invariably, things go as h squared.
So is it just symmetry, is it omega minus omega?
Okay, that's the a priori argument. But in the end, it gives you the right result. And I think you'll see that.
I mean, if you plug here something wrong in, it doesn't fit our data.
I mean, this is that at the end you will get the right dependence of the area.
Okay, so you apply the small perturbation. You get an expression for the growth rate sigma, which is, it depends, of course, on the inverse of Rossby and the wave number you applied in, and you can calculate a neutral curve. That means where is the growth rate of this small perturbation zero.
I'm sorry, it should be C naught squared, K squared.
Yeah.
In the sigma.
Right, sorry. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's a linear growth rate, right? That's a linear growth rate.
Yeah, right.
Look at that. In an obvious talk, you would have here viscosity, for example, as a linear factor, which would be inverse Reimers number. This number is also positive, just by definition. But it doesn't mean that it always comes Reimers number square. So,
okay, let's just say we will see that.
It's just a very basically simple. Very powerful physical argument why the instability rate is a squared vorticity. There must be some kind of a physical argument.
You would be happier if we had put in here the Taylor number. Then you wouldn't have even asked a question. And the Taylor number is proportional to 1 over Rossby squared.
Yeah, right.
And so then you would be happy.
Maybe not.
I would say that probably omega squared radius is an acceleration. That would probably make for a good physical argument. That's how actually it comes to the Taylor number. So that acceleration is omega squared. And that's why it must be Rossby squared. Because that's what drives vortices.
Yeah, that's true.
Now you're completely.
The non-linear term, how do you argue for it?
Well, maybe I say something when it comes out here. Let me just say something about the neutral curve. Sorry that I missed here the square. So if you set the growth rate to zero, you can calculate the neutral curve, and you see it is linear and proportional to the wave number k. And if you plot the neutral curve in this k one of Rossby diagram, in this region, the growth rate is positive. That means the small instabilities are amplified and the zero solution is unstable. In this region, it is negative, so small perturbations are damped. But the interesting thing is what this tells us, that for any inverse Rossby number, you find a perturbation so that the system is driven out of this zero solution. So it should not be stable, and you always have a finite local vortex density. So you can ask what happens. You have a perturbation, to which solution does the system converge? And at least if you assume a homogeneous solution, then you can easily calculate, well, this you neglect, and then you can calculate a second solution that is proportional to 1 over Rossby. And you get also square root, 1 over square root of this g in it. So now this maybe answers already your question in a way, because in the numerical simulation we had a kind of a linear behavior here. So it's nice if we get also a linear behavior over there. And if you put something else here, you don't get a linear relationship anymore. Okay. So,
I mean, usually you argue for that cubic term by up-down symmetry, but that doesn't seem like it applies here. I mean, is there anything beyond it works and gives the right result that you can?
Well, I mean, you also can argue with the up-down symmetry because we don't care whether you have. I mean, I have to say there also vortices that go in one direction and vortices that are in the other direction, but most of them go in one direction. And well, but if you don't care about the direction of a vortex, you just say how many vortices are there and how many surface area do they occupy, then it should be pretty symmetric, the system. And then you can argue for the cubic term.
But they don't have negative A.
Well, yes, there's no negative A. It could be on
the because in a way, you could take 1 over root instead of 1 over root squared, and you could take quadratic term instead.
Exactly,
of
it would give
still the right
for the homogeneous solution.
But and you don't want it, so that's why.
But you get in trouble a little later on.
That's I suspect, yeah. Yeah, of course, yeah. And you don't have a Ginzburg-Landau anymore.
Sorry?
If you don't have a cubic and you don't have the Ginzburg-Landau anymore.
Well, okay, but let's just, well, in pattern formation, people don't care how it looks in comparison to the real Ginzburg-Landau equation. Just take the terms you would like to have.
It's if you put in a quadratic term, then you have a transcritical bifurcation, and you would have to explain where that comes from. Yeah. And we really expect a supercritical bifurcation. Yeah. And to get a supercritical bifurcation, having put in the 1 over Rossby squared, we now need an A cubed.
Yeah, that's now one leads to another.
Okay, but I would point out that in the infinite system that we considered here, the zero is not a solution. The zero is never stable because you always can find a wave number so that the system becomes unstable. So the situation changes a little bit if we have a finite system. Since we have a cylindrical finite system, we want to write out this equation or just the Laplace operator in terms of polar coordinates. We're interested in, we assume that the solution is symmetric with respect of rotation in the azimuthal direction, so we neglect this term. And we do a rescaling. We find a new spatial variable r prime, which is scaled, which is proportional to r, and the proportionality vector is xi zero and rho. And in a steady case, this equation looks then like this. If you are interested only for very small amplitudes, we can neglect for right now the cubic term. And we know the solutions of this equation. These are the Bessel functions. To remind you, one Bessel function looks like this. That's y0. And this function is pretty unphysical because it becomes minus infinity close to 0. So therefore, we only consider this j0. And we demand that this has to fulfill the boundary conditions. As I said, the vortices. The vortex density has to be 0 because there cannot be a vortex at the sidewall. And this gives us the boundary condition. Let's stop here. So this is our boundary condition. And out of this, we immediately get that gamma 1/2 should be equal to this one. And r0 prime is just this R0 where the Bessel function crosses the x-axis. And out of this relationship, we get something out for our critical inverse Rossby number. Put this on the other side, and then I get something. The inverse critical Rossby number is proportional to the inverse of the aspect ratio with a proportionality factor that is constant. So just, I said in other words, there is no solution, no positive solution for A, as long as the inverse Rossby number is smaller than the critical value. So this comes out, and that's what we want. So we can check now this expression with our experimental data we have. We plotted here the inverse aspect ratio versus the inverse critical Rossby number, and you see that these points correspond pretty much to a linear line, but we fitted a quadratic curve, but you see that the quadratic term is much smaller than the linear term. And out of this linear term, we can get actually our psi zero, which we will use for further calculations now. Okay, what I said.
Could I just get back to the issue you raised? If we had chosen one of our OSPI for the coefficient of the linear term and a squared for the nonlinearity, then we would get a 1 over the square root of gamma at this point for one of the OSPI critical.
Okay,
and 1 over the square root of gamma doesn't fit the data.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, the equation is good if it fits the data. It's well, it should be a little bit physical.
That's experimentalistic. Physicians would like to get it without looking at the data. And it must be, I guess. The acceleration is only the square, that's probably. But Bob was right. I mean, this A cube is not evident because usually we say there is a symmetry up down, which makes your action force power. It's kind of.
We struggled with what choice to make.
Okay, but now this is only valid, these Bessel functions are only valid very close to the onset. If you go above the onset, if you have a finite amplitude, of course you have to take the cubic term into consideration again. Then we cannot solve this equation analytically, or at least we don't know how to. So we just put it into the computer and integrate it numerically. And the result is shown here on these slides. And in order to have compare really the profiles of A, we just normalized every A by the vortex density for the infinite case, A2. So what you see here, very close to the onset, it's just 1% above the critical inverse Rossby number. The blue curve is the numerical result from this equation, and the dashed lines are the Bessel function. You see the Bessel function fits very well this blue curve as expected. If you go a little bit higher for 10% above the critical inverse Rossby number, you see there's a slight deviation. The Bessel function doesn't fit completely anymore, but it's still a pretty good approximation. If you go now to a much higher inverse Rossby number, then you get curves like here. At the beginning, they are just curves similar to the Bessel function, but if you increase the rotation rate or the inverse Rossby number, you get curves that show pretty much a plateau in the bulk region, and then they have a depletion zone where A goes down to zero. And the more you increase the inverse Rossby number, the thinner this zone becomes. But since also the amplitude in the bulk increases, the comparison between the infinite solution and the solution in finite system is different by a pretty steady value. Well, this is basically shown here on the next slide or on the next plot. This is the infinite solution. This is the average over the whole surface of A, and you see it goes pretty parallel to it. In comparison to this, this is A max, this is A in the middle of our cell, and this of course goes asymptotically close to the infinite solution. We can also plot the results for different aspect ratios. You see here they have different onsets, and then they go, well, it looks better they go asymptotically to the infinite solution, but I want to note that this is kind of a trick. We just plotted the logarithmic here, but you see that the difference becomes less important in comparison to the overall vortex density. So now we want to compare our results with the experiment that is far away from the onset. And this is a little bit complicated because our experiments in gamma 1 and gamma 1 half cell, they're different because we doubled the height of our cell. And this gives us a factor 8 in the Rayleigh number. And therefore, it's the overlap between the Rayleigh number range of the gamma 1 and the gamma 1 half cell is pretty small. In fact, we only have 3 sets of measurements where we really have the same Rayleigh number in gamma 1 and gamma 1 half cells. why in this set the temperature difference in the gamma 1 half set was super small, just half a Kelvin, and therefore the data are not very good. They don't even show these onsets because they also fluctuate very much. Just for the legend, I said it, oh, I plotted it here. The red points are the values for the gamma 1 experiment. The blue circles are for the gamma 1 half experiment. And we assume a relation like this, that only that, well, this is the reduced Nusselt number, and only the part that, that enhances the Nusselt number is due to Ekman pumping, which we claim is proportional to our vortex density, or the, well, there is a bar missing. It's of course not the vortex density, it's the average vortex density over the whole cross-section. So we assume that B is only only depends on the Rayleigh number, but is independent of gamma, because we hope that all the dependence of gamma is included already in our A. So let's focus more on these two plots, because as I said, here this reproduces well the data for gamma 1 experiments, but not very well the data for the gamma 2 experiment, just because the temperature difference is so small. Here the situation, even though the temperature difference is still small, it's just 1 Kelvin, it looks better. We have exactly the same beta for, we use the same beta for the gamma 1 experiments and the gamma 2 experiments. You see there is already a good fit. I mean, I have to point out that this model is very basic and should only apply very close to the onset. But if you increase the Rayleigh number, the fit is, well, our model is even closer to the actual measurements we have. Okay, that's the end of my first part. Let's just summarize. I showed you that rotation leads to a heat enhancement, an enhancement of the heat transport, and the result or the reason is that there is Ekman pumping, and we have, or this Ekman pumping sets in only above a critical inverse Rossby number. And this critical inverse Rossby number depends on the aspect ratio, and we propose a Ginzburg-Landau-like model that explains this increase as a finite effect, as an effect due to the finite extension of the system. Okay, let's come to my next part of the talk. That is, I want to say something about a large-scale circulation in cylinders with aspect ratio 1/2. Last week, Eric Braun gave the talk about cylinders with aspect ratio 1, and he studied the large-scale shear flow, and, or the large-scale circulation, and also its dynamics. And we do a very similar approach. We have, this is our cell, and we have 24 thermistors equally distributed along the sidewall at three different height levels, and at each level there are 8 thermistors equally distributed azimuthally. And if you have a large scale shear flow in this direction, then the hot flow rises on this side and the cold fluid falls down on this side, and this gives you a signature at these thermistors that looks a little bit like a bar. This is very close to a sinus function, and therefore it's a good idea to fit the sinus function to these curves or to these points. In comparison to Eric Braun's measurement, we have now three rows of thermistors instead of only one. And if you fit the sinus or cosine curve, you get information of first the strength of the LC due to the amplitude here. We get also, and the second important parameter is the orientation of the LC due to the theta car here. And well, basically what you see here at 0.5, the fluid flows up here, and at 1.5, the fluid flows down. One quarter of the set right here flows up, and there flows down. Okay, let's compare the dynamics of the large scale circulation for gamma 1 and gamma 1/2. This is the signature of the orientation measured with the middle thermistor row. It's, well, as Eric explained, the LSC is not steady in space, but usually diffuses around. And also the amplitude is not steady, but it fluctuates. It strongly fluctuates over a mean value here. And something interesting happens if you plot the difference between what you measured at the top and what you measured at the bottom. And this is very often steady. It fluctuates a little bit around. This is due to some twisting motion of the LSC. And once in a while, you have jumps like here. They have different reasons. I don't want to talk too much about this here. But they are very rare. I mean, this is 5 × 10⁴ seconds. And they occur actually 1 to 3 times. And the situation is quite different if you go to aspect ratio cells of 1/2. You don't really see it here in the diffusion of the LSC. It looks like it's a little bit more erratic, but you see it especially if you look at the amplitude. It fluctuates much more, and in fact, it very, very often goes down to 0 here and there and there. And if you plot the same quantity, that is the orientation measured at the top thermistor row and the orientation measured at the bottom thermistor row, it is not flat as here and has 1 or 2 jumps, but it constantly jumps around. And especially note that the scale is completely different. I mean, this is both normalized by pi, but here it goes from -4 to 3, and here it goes from -1 to 21. So it very often loses completely the coherence between the top and the bottom, and maybe turn around or whatever. And most of these cases can actually be explained by a phenomenon called flow mode transition. We just want to look what happens here when the amplitude goes to 0, and we plot several values, that is the amplitude of the large-scale circulation measured at the bottom, is the red, the middle, that's the green, and the top, that's the blue. And what you see, they all go down, not to 0, but very close to 0, but not at the same time. So the top goes first down, then it increases again, then the middle goes down, and then the bottom goes down. Not at the same time, it's always at slightly different times. But what is also interesting, if you look at this quantity, the top orientation minus the middle orientation. And what you see that this quantity, well, is well pretty close to 1.
Bottom.
The top minus bottom, sorry. Yeah. It's pretty close to 1. 1, I mean, I made a little mistake. Here it's normalized by pi, and here it's normalized by 2 pi. But, well, everything's correct. It's just not.
So when it's y, they're the same.
When it's exactly, when it's 2 pi, it's the same, yeah. Right? Or multiples of 2 pi, it's the same. So you can basically shift this scale by multiples of in this case, multiples of 1, because I scaled it by 2 pi, right? So, but you see here, this quantity is very close to 1. So maybe they fluctuate a little bit off-centered, but it's 1 row, as shown here. And then it goes down, and it takes a value of 1/2, well, 1 pi, basically. 1/2 of 2 pi is 1 pi. And this means that the signature is completely different. On the top, it rotates in one direction, and on the bottom, it rotates in the other direction, as shown here. And then
it never stops at pi over 2, like the perpendicular.
No, we didn't observe. Yeah. I mean, we didn't observe these kind of steps. But here it really stops, and it's pretty much a plateau. And this also, by the way, explains very nicely why the amplitude goes down to 0. Because here you have basically the same temperature. There's no temperature variation because the fluid does not flow up and down. And here it also doesn't flow up and down. Therefore, you have along this line basically the same temperature. Because the temperature at the sidewall only comes because of the warm fluid that goes up and the cold that goes down. So, and then this stays for, let's say 100 seconds, and then it's
here. It stops for a while at pi over 2, right? But you interpret it not as two perpendicular.
I mean, I have to say that it is a little bit complicated to interpret this area, because you see that at the bottom, the amplitude is very small.
Ah, yeah.
So you cannot really say where it is, because maybe you don't have anything there. Yeah? So you have to be very careful. And then it goes back basically to zero. So how we interpreted it is shown here. First, you have a roll. Then the roll, goes down a little bit here. There's some space where you don't have motion, or we don't know what happens because we don't have thermistors there. But then after a while, you have two counter-rotating rolls on top of each other, where the new roll that occurred at the top replaces finally the old roll. So the first, the resulting single roll rotates in a different direction than the first single roll. This is shown even better at the next slide, where I plot again here the same quantity as in the previous slide, but on this scale I print the orientation of the orientation of what we measured in the middle, of the large scale circulation, what we measured in the middle. And you see here it's around 0.5. Then here it goes down. Well, we don't have any information here because the amplitude is basically zero, so the fit is pretty poor. But then it ends up at zero. So it made really a jump of 1 pi. Yeah, it goes around. And I have to say, things like this were first discovered in the group of Catching Shaw in Hong Kong, but they're also very nice results on in two-dimensional convection. This gamma one. There are numerics in the Defloses group, but also experiments by Catching Shaw. And what this shows really nice, that at the beginning you have a single roll, and then you have in the corners a flow that rotates in the other direction. And these corner flows, they increase and replace finally the big roll. And in this time, you have a double circulation. Well, it's not really on top of each other. One is more on this corner and the other is on this corner. But you have two convection rolls on top of each other. I also want to mention that the sketch is maybe a little bit imprecise, because I plotted just an ellipse and said this is the large-scale circulation. And in reality, these large-scale circulations are usually inclined. So they basically the fluid flows from this corner to this corner and then up in this corner. And then you have always a little bit space where theoretically a small corner roll can develop that might be the reason for this flow mode transition. But from our experiment, we cannot say much about this since we only have these three rolls. So you can ask, in this case, there's a change of the orientation of the LSC by a factor of pi. How likely is this? Or are there other states? And we plotted, this is the probability density function of the change of orientation of the middle thermistor row before a flow mode transition and after a flow mode transition. You see they go up for close to pi, so that you have a higher probability that you have a large-scale circulation changes its orientation. And you have a rather small possibility that it doesn't change, because sometimes we also saw that, in example, a small row grows, but then it disappears back in this direction, yeah, so that the original one survives. But in general, the probability distribution function is pretty smooth out, and it's not like as we expected originally that you have two peaks. But one of the reasons also that the LSC is not steady during this time, but it diffuses around, and this might smooth out also a possible peak here and maybe a tiny peak here. Another interesting thing is to measure how much of the time during an experiment does the system spend in a double rolled state, and how much time does it spend in a single rolled state. And this is plotted here. The solid red symbols are for the single rolled state, and a double the red open symbols are for the double rolled states. There are previous experiments by Heng Dong-Chi and Catching Shaw that fit pretty much our results, but they only consider a rather small Rayleigh number range. We in fact have two apparatus and can cover a very large Rayleigh number range. And you see that for very small Rayleigh number, actually the double rolled state is dominant. and you have only a little bit of the single rolled state. And if you increase the Rayleigh number, the single rolled states appears more, much more often, and the double rolled states much less. But the other interesting thing is that you have for a small Rayleigh number a lot, a huge amount of time where the system is in no defined state, so where you neither have a clear double rolled state and also no clear single rolled state. So another interesting thing is to look how does the Nusselt number, the heat transport, corresponds to these two flow states. So what you can do, you can build up a function, a state function that is 1 when the system is in a single rolled state and is -1 otherwise. And the same thing as you do with for a function that is 1 when the system is in double rolled state and -1 otherwise. And you just calculate the gross correlation between our Nusselt number measurements versus time and these state functions. And what you see is that the correlation that the function that correlates Nusselt number and state function for the single rolled state increases and has a peak and then decreases again, while the correlation between Nusselt and the state function of the double rolled state decreases. And this basically states that if you get a single rolled state, the Nusselt number increases, and if you get a double rolled state, the Nusselt number decreases slightly.
And is it growth of Rayleigh numbers a double state actually means, right?
No, so it's growth.
It's getting more probable.
No, the single state.
Ah, single state means.
Yes.
Ah, so it's more flux state means.
Exactly. But there, what you see here on our next slide, we compare the Nusselt number in this double roll and with the Nusselt number in a single roll, and you see, first of all, the difference is not very big. It's maximum for a small Rayleigh number, it's not even 2%, and if you increase the Rayleigh number, it becomes even smaller, up to 1%. So this is, it's very only has a minor contribution to the heat and to the heat transport. Okay, let's shortly summarize before I come to my last point. We saw, well, I showed you that the dynamics of the LSC is very different between gamma 1 and gamma 1 half. In gamma 1 half cells, it's much more erratic, and especially so-called flow mode transition to a double rolled state, they occur in gamma 1 half. And this double rolled state has transports the heat a little bit less effective, but the difference is rather small. Okay, now I want to say something in the last 5 minutes on the effect of rotation on the LSC. The question is, how long does the LSC still exist? I mean, it's expected if you rotate fast enough, you create Taylor columns, and that must destroy the flow. So our colleagues in the Netherlands, they come up with a formula like this. So you should measure the first Fourier mode of the distribution of our thermistors, compare it with the total energy in all modes. And then this minus 1 and the division by 1 over minus 1, this just enables that this function is 0 when all modes have the same energy, and is 1 if all the energy is in the first mode. Just to remind you, we used, well, these are the measurements of our sidewall thermometers, and we used just a sinus curve, basically only one mode, in order to fit this. But it doesn't say, I mean, this looks very sinusoidal, but it doesn't say that there are no higher order modes hidden.
What's velocity or temperature?
This is the temperature. I have to say,
but
very important.
Is about velocity or its potential, I mean, what is...
No, well, it's a Fourier mode. What's the mode in the power spectrum.
The temperature.
The temperature spectrum, just a power in the mode.
I mean, it's just the Fourier decomposition of these 8 points. Yeah? So the highest mode is 4. Right? This is only what we have, because we only have 8
why
points.
Why talk about shear if you actually ask about temperature profiles?
Okay, because we think that, well, it's believed that this large scale, the large scale circulation, this is correlated to the temperature profile.
Definitely has a temperature imprint. Yes.
Okay. So we have this number S, which is 0 is if every mode is equal, and it is 1 if all the energy is in first Fourier mode. So now, let's look first on the left side. These are data from our gamma 1 cell, and here are plotted the different modes, and here are plotted the quantity S for the middle thermistor row and the bottom thermistor row. We didn't have the top thermistor row, but the qualitatively everything looks very likely the same. But you see that the first mode is completely dominant until here. This is, by the way, our critical inverse Rossby number, and then it drops down and becomes, the second mode becomes more dominant, which basically says that a large-scale circulation is pretty much destroyed, or the signature is pretty much destroyed due to, I don't know, Taylor columns or due to rotation. The situation is very different, surprisingly, for the aspect ratio 1/2 cells. Here you see that here it's more pronounced, you also see it here a little bit, that the first mode even increases due to slow rotation. It means that it seems that the large scale circulation is stabilized. And then it decreases again, but it never becomes even goes even close to the other modes, which looks like that the LSC is still there. However, of course, if you increase the rotation rate, it has to get destroyed. And I just want to show you also another example at very high rotation rates. This is 1/3.6. The critical inverse Rossby was 0.8 here, and you still see, I mean, they deviate a little bit from the sinusoidal profile, but nevertheless, they still have the signature of a large-scale circulation. This is taken around here. Okay. On this graph, there's shown, again, the difference of the orientation at different height levels of, let's say, the orientation of the LSC. Red is the bottom minus the middle, green is the top minus the bottom, and blue is top minus the middle. And it's very similar to the plot I've showed you before. There's a strong erratic fluctuation. They sometimes stay on these plateau and fluctuate strongly, but very often they have jumps of 2 pi just because, for example, flow mode transition or other incidences that the flow is partially not well defined and therefore the fit is not very good. But if you switch on rotation, actually it looks much more like in the gamma 1 cells. You have much less fluctuation here, and you have only very, very few steps. And this is a very strong statement that small rotation actually really increases the stability of the large-scale circulation. Even more, it does not only increase the stability of the large-scale circulation, it also increases the stability of the single row structure. Here is again the ratio the system spends in the double row and the single row structure. The left side is for the single row structure, the right side is for the double row structure. And I need to point out, as you've shown before, at this Rayleigh numbers, there's most of the time the system is in a single row structure, and therefore I choose two different scales. Now, this is 0.08 and this is 0.8. But you see that the single row structure becomes much more pronounced from, let's say, something around 65% of the time up to 100% of the time the single structure exists, while the double row structure is very strongly suppressed. I mean, this regime, there's basically always a single row structure and never a double row structure. If you increase the angular velocity even more of the cylinder or the rotation rate, then system the situation changes a little bit. The single row structure becomes less pronounced, but it seems to still exist in this range. Okay. Another very interesting thing is to see how this large-scale circulation behaves inside the container. This is just the orientation with respect to time. You see, it's a straight line just because it rotates with respect to the cylinder. And you can fit a line and you can calculate kind of a rotation rate of the large-scale circulation. And you can plot it here. And there's a very remarkable thing that for small rotation rate, for small inverse Rossby number, the rotation of the large-scale circulation goes in prograde rotation. It means it rotates in the direction of the of our container, but in the same direction as our container rotates, which is very unexpected. And it was also not seen in gamma 1 cell. Because in gamma 1, you expect you have kind of a wheel that goes around and the angular momentum wants to have it steady and you just rotate the cylinder around and you have a little bit drag at the sidewalls and therefore it rotates, but much slower, or in the rotating frame, it looks like it rotates in the other direction. Basically due to Coriolis force. In this case, it rotates in the same direction. So if you look in the lab frame, the LC actually, it looks like, rotates faster than our container. And this is valid up to this point. And then the LC goes pretty much with our container. And then here we have the expected behavior, the retrograde rotation. So in this case, it's as expected that the LSC rotates slower, or in the rotating frame, it goes in backward direction. Okay, there's a little bit more to say, but I think we rather take it for the discussions, I would say. Or is there? I mean, there's one important thing, but it maybe takes a little bit longer to explain, that you have. Surprisingly, the rotation rate seems to be different at the bottom and the top in comparison to the middle. So here is the middle. It seems to rotate in the middle a little bit faster than at the top and the bottom. And you can plot here the signatures, and you see it's indeed faster. But one reason is, you also see that in the bottom and the top, you have always these jumps of 2 pi. Which you don't have in the middle. And therefore, it seems that the rotation is faster in the middle than at the top and the bottom. But if you look at this slide, where you just calculate the momentary rotation just between 2 measurement points and plot it as a probability density functions, then you see, well, this is without rotation. It is as it should, as it expected. You have most of the time, you have no rotation of the LSC with respect to the container. But if you switch on the rotation, then it goes in one direction. You have a slight rotation, a momentary rotation. But you also see that the maximum of the green curve are not at the same point as the maximum of the blue and the red curve, which means that it's not just due to these jumps, but it's also in between 2 jumps that you have. In the middle, it rotates a little bit faster than at bottom and top. Okay, well, with this, let's come to the summary. I showed you that slow rotation, that's the interesting fact, can stabilize the large-scale circulation, and that also it favors the single rolled state. And then something very unexpected, we have a prograde rotation for slow rotation of the cylinder, a prograde rotation of the single roll of the large-scale circulation. And while I haven't shown you this, but there are some other interesting facts. These jumps are due to partial breaks of the large-scale circulation. Okay, with this last slide, I want to thank you for your attention.